When Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring was performed in Paris in 1913, the audience made catcalls and threw things at the orchestra. The same year in New York, guards had to protect a modern painting of a nude from possible violence by scandalized viewers. Just two examples of art as provocation. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
For over a century, writers, composers, pianists, and other artists have been censored, banned, and placed on trial. What role should the arts play in a democracy? When does the public have the right to pull the plug on publicly funded art? Should art be chosen by majority rule? Joining us for these and other questions is Caroline Levine, professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the author of Provoking Democracy, Why We Need the Arts.
Welcome to University of the Air.
It's great to be here.
Well, isn't the answer to this whole thing really simple? If I don't like it, it shouldn't be out there in my way.
That's certainly an understandable answer, but one of the surprises I had in doing research for this book was that I realized that I was gradually coming to believe that we should actually fund art we don't like. And that's because we're used to thinking about democracies as being free societies. But in fact, because democracies are organized around the logic of majorities, and majorities are sometimes perfectly willing to squelch unpopular expression, we actually need artists because they needle us. They act as provocateurs, kind of constantly getting us to think outside of what we have become familiar with and comfortable with.
And what do you mean when you say democracy? Only those governments that have, you know, I mean, in other words, your title, Provoking Democracy, Why We Need the Arts.
Well, I began with the assumption that democracies would be great societies for artists. That's what we heard all the way through the Cold War, that democracies are free societies. But it looks to me as though a lot of democracies, including India, Israel, Great Britain, the U.S., have actually had been perfectly happy to censor and ban artistic expression. And so I do mean democratic governments of all kinds.
And art does flourish in a way in non-democratic situations. I'm thinking of, you know, Stalinist Russia. There was all kinds of art. It was just sort of streamed for the good of the people, right? And it was very easy to make those decisions, wasn't it, in that case?
Well, certainly when you have an official art style, government dictates to artists what they can do, then the artist has not such difficult decisions to make. That's absolutely true. And it's during the Cold War that U.S. politicians were actually pretty close, a lot of them were pretty close to the Soviets in terms of saying things like, oh, this abstract art, it's subversive and it's communistic. So the Soviets were saying, oh, this abstract art is capitalistic, and, you know, it was upsetting people on both sides. And so there were actually movements in Congress to squelch abstract art.
And at the same time in this country, by which I mean the 30s in particular, there was government sponsorship, actually fairly aggressive sponsorship of certain kinds of art.
Yes. The New Deal programs were some of the most effective government support for the art programs that we've ever had. The federal support for the Works Projects Administration. It was kind of amazing, actually. They paid artists. They were trying to figure out how to have a work program based on art. And art, of course, isn't like other kinds of work. But they tried to make it look like other kinds of work. So they asked artists to clock in and clock out. And they also paid them by the yard for certain kinds, or by the inch for certain kinds of paintings and murals. And that came under fire by the growing concern over communist effects on public culture. And so there was a sense that a democracy couldn't actually tolerate that much freedom in the arts, and it was going to have to start cutting down on public support for the arts because the artists themselves were too left-wing and they were undermining American culture. So it's a case where democracy says, in the name of unity, we actually have to prescribe a certain kind of art rather than letting artists be free to
There was that great instance in Rockefeller Center, too.
Yes, the
Speaking
Rivera
of the surprisingly left-wing artists.
Absolutely.
Well, I like the way you start your book with a mid-1990s survey by two Russian artists who go around taking polls to see what kind of art would please the greatest number of people. Can you talk about that and why you start your book that way?
Sure. There are a couple of Russian artists, Komar and Melamed, who have come to the U.S., but they grew up under Soviet rule in Russia. And they were kind of fascinated by democracy and the relationship between art and democracy, and they decided to try this experiment. And I've never figured out how tongue-in-cheek this experiment is, but where they conduct national polls, and they actually use professional pollsters, and they ask people, what's your favorite color? What's your favorite style? What's your favorite kind of subject matter? Do you like nudes or clothed figures? And then they paint a single painting to represent the majority tastes in each national group. And so you get a lot of light blue landscapes, which is what people in a lot of countries like, and George Washington is in the America's Most Wanted image. So they're kind of poking fun. They're also exploring the question of majority preferences in the arts, but they're poking fun at that idea that the best art is the art that pleases everyone.
There's a great irony in that too, in that Washington, because if I remember the story right, the Washington painting that's maybe most familiar to us that is sort of incomplete is because he and Martha couldn't stand it.
Right. Well, politicians don't always have the most refined aesthetic tastes.
Can you read the comment by Congressman Hyde that you include in the early part of your book as well and talk about that?
Sure. U.S. Congressman Henry Hyde, who's a Republican from Illinois, argues that it's a mistake to fund artists who aren't pleasing the majority. He says, public funds in a democracy are to be spent for public purposes, not for the satisfaction of individuals' aesthetic impulses. And if the impulse in question produces a work which is palpably offensive to the sensibilities of a significant proportion of the public, then that work ought not to be supported by public funds. So here we get a kind of classic standoff between the idea of the individualist artist who stands on the margins and then the public who has certain kinds of tastes and values. And should art actually serve those tastes and values, or does art do its best job when it pokes at them and upsets them? And I come down firmly on the other side and not on the Henry Hyde side of that.
Well, debate. Let's see. It gets a little tricky, doesn't it? Because if you take the Henry Hyde side, you would have no artistic advances.
That's exactly right.
Sort of the public slowly gets tired of one thing and as a majority, presumably, then want something else but might not even be able to define what that is. Now, on the other hand, if you leave it up to the artist to be the innovator and to be the poker and the prodder, the artist, as we have seen, is perfectly capable of going out on a weird tangent that is expressive without communicating anything to anyone else. So somewhere in between, I suppose, has to lie the middle ground.
Well, you know, it's exactly why I wrote this book. I was struck by a kind of contradiction in what people say about art. On the one hand, people would say art is for everyone, it's universal, it's good for a civilization. And just about as often, you would hear people say, if you try to get an art that pleases everybody, you get mediocrity. So is art for the few or is art for the many? And that's why I think, and what I discovered doing this research, in just about every major controversy over the arts, the question of democracy is right at the center of that. It's not a marginal question. It's always this question about whether art should serve the many. And looking at a number of cases where individual artists had gone off on weird and wacky tangents, it seemed to me that the real question was about freedom of expression in democracies. And, of course, the question of public funding complicates this a little bit. But what latitude does the artist have to speak? And what is offensiveness? And how do we think of a public culture? And if we rely on the marketplace and we keep buying the things we already like, maybe we also don't get innovation. And so maybe that weird wackiness that artists sometimes shock us with and we don't like it at all, maybe that's also essential for kind of pushing us to new thoughts and new possibilities. And that's why we should fund it even when we don't like it.
And isn't one of the problems that all of us know that art that we might find distasteful or odd or incomprehensible a century later will be looked on as works of great genius? Because, you know, we opened with the Stravinsky piece, which to our ears now doesn't sound so bad because we've heard a lot more atonal kinds of dissonant things. We know that William Blake was called a lunatic, but now he's kind of mainstream. So it's we kind of know that we might dismiss something that later generations will hail as great. And we're a little bit afraid of that, don't you think?
Absolutely. It puts us in a strange position to have to say, I'm going to support art I don't like because later people might like it. You know, how do you come to terms with that? But there are so many examples of artists broadening public taste in a way that, you know, people sometimes say, oh, once the artwork gets mainstream, it's been co-opted. It's not doing its work anymore. But you could say sort of a different take on the same problem would be to say, no, the artist has done exactly what the artist is supposed to do. That is, by giving us this provocation that we weren't expecting, has forced us to confront a way of seeing that actually expands the possibility of what can be said at all. I often think in this regard of Maya Lin's Vietnam War Memorial, which when it first went up was really, there was a lot of outcry. People said, this is not what a memorial should look like. It should be a guy on a horse, or it should be people raising a flag, right? And people have come to say, no, this is actually a more moving and more meaningful memorial, precisely because it doesn't stick with convention in a way that, you know, is not memorable in quite the same way. So she's broadened our sense of what a memorial could look like and opened the way to a lot more kinds of experiments in the construction of memorials.
To what extent is the problem choosing who judges? Because in that case, it was a competition, right, in terms of what the memorial would be. It's one thing if we all go to a store and buy art for our home. But in the case of grant funding or competitions, Pulitzer Prizes or other things, some sort of judgments being made, or as to what goes in a museum and what does not.
You know, I don't think we can get away from judgment. There's always some kind of judgment, whether it's a big mass public judgment, consumer judgment, or the art world's judgment. One of the things that I found kind of fascinating when I was looking at some of the cases where artists have been censored or banned and there's a question of whether they should be included in a public culture, in a museum or for a commission like that, is that there's a sense of a deep divide between public taste and art world taste, as though those were necessarily antagonistic. And there's a sense that the art world is elitist and it stands above the ordinary citizen and tries to thumb its nose at us, the rest of us ordinary citizens. But I came to think that this was actually a mistake, that the art world is not so much elitist as committed to alternatives. So they are uncomfortable, the art world's judgments generally, but that discomfort doesn't mean that they're deliberately leaving us out. There's also an invitation for us to make sense of these confusing and complicated artworks.
I suppose some of the solution lies in how that art is going to be used. The first thing I thought of when you started talking about the divide was clothing, fashion, which is considered by some to be a form of art, you know, those Paris fashions. And certainly it could be a dress that costs, what, $2 million? Mm-hmm. And the wearer doesn't wear it just to stay warm. The wearer wears it as a work of art. But people do buy that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you and I don't have to pay tax dollars to support it.
Right, right. And of course, there's some of that in the art world, too. There's some very expensive works of art bought by very wealthy individuals. And then nobody sees it, right? And it's kind of trickle-down taste you know, the rest of us get access through other channels. I don't think that there's as big a division as we like to think between the outsider artist and the mainstream culture, as much as there's a kind of feedback loop where the artist provokes us and then mainstream culture takes up that provocation eventually. And then the artist often takes little pieces of mainstream culture and plays with them. And so the divide is useful in the sense that if we constantly think of artists as outsiders, that helps us to think about what's not included in the mainstream, what views, what alternative perspectives might not be represented. But it's not a thorough and deep division. So the kind of fashion circuit is a good example of that. You get haute couture, and that seems very often very startling. Like, who would wear that? On the other hand, it seeps into the ready-to-wear market also.
Oh, yes. It definitely trickles down. Well, what about the other extreme? If you look at the Velvet Elvis.
Right. You know, the kitsch.
Who is to say that it is kitsch?
And the paint by numbers.
People clearly buy that. It's visible to the public. It has its following. I suppose you could make the case that it's making a statement of some kind, that it has some deeper meaning that good art should have. But who's to say which is which?
A lot of postmodern artists have deliberately taken up kitsch and said, you know, let's think about what mass culture is made of and what people buy and what taste is made up of. And they've tried to kind of take that apart.
By kitsch, we mean that which is cliched.
Cliched, popular in a way that doesn't have claims to highbrow status. Clement Greenberg, the art critic in the 30s and 40s, who was a big fan of abstract expressionism, famously set up this division between the avant-garde on the one hand and kitsch on the other hand. And the avant-garde being the artist who's standing at the forefront of civilization and kind of provoking us to think new thoughts, and kitsch, which is widely disseminated and doesn't challenge anybody and is kind of looked down on by anybody who has cultured credentials.
Well, that's a problem. It's subjective, isn't it?
To pick up on the clothing idea, what about the protection from the emperor having no clothes? In other words, there is a lot of pretentiousness and affectation in the art world, in aesthetics.
White on white.
Yeah. I mean, if you imagine a canvas that's just all white and a bunch of art critics praising its, you know, and there have been instances where a piece of cardboard chewed by a dog wins an art contest and the critics are discussing its aesthetic texture and its statement and everything. So we know that there's some of that Emperor in New Clothes where nobody wants to be the one that says, I don't like it and my four-year-old could paint his, you know, well, what kind of protection is built into the system so that we can distinguish between avant-garde art that we want to nurture and junk?
I think that's a great question, Emily, but I also think that there is no protection built in. I think what we could do as ordinary public citizens is to make one move that I feel is very important. One of the things that happens when people censor art, like when Rudy Giuliani was mayor of New York and the Sensation Show was happening and causing a lot of scandal, he was particularly upset about a painting by a Nigerian-born, British-based artist named Chris Ofili, which was a painting called Holy Virgin Mary that had – it was kind of placed on two pieces of elephant dung. And Giuliani said – you know, it's sacrilege, it's offensive to smear elephant dung, which in fact was not smeared, but to smear elephant dung on the Virgin Mary, it's offensive, we should close down the Brooklyn Museum and certainly never fund it again. One of the fascinating things about that story, I think, is that Giuliani never looked at the painting. So when we talk about protection from the emperors having no clothes, it seems to me one of the things we can always do is open ourselves up to actually interpreting a work of art and thinking, what might this mean? Why might it be valuable? I know as a teacher myself, I'm often introducing works of art to students that they resist. They're too complicated. They're difficult. James Joyce or, you know, whatever, Virginia Woolf. It seems unnecessarily complicated and elitist. But they are always capable of interpreting that in ways that are interesting and valuable. And it challenges them to grow. And I think what's true on an individual level with individual students is also true with us more generally as a public. It challenges us to grow to say, why might this be valuable? What kind of act might this be? What associations do we have with it? Why, as an artist, might you choose this over that? And that kind of skills of actual interpretive engagement often change your relationship to a work of art.
The government as a patron, help or hindrance? We'll look at that issue when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Sign up for Wisconsin Public Radio's monthly e-newsletter to find out about all things WPR. You'll get in-depth information on programs, news, and upcoming events. Go to WPR.org to sign up today.
There are those around the world, indeed even those in democracies with the longest tradition of free speech and expression, who would attempt to limit the artist to what is acceptable, conventional, comfortable. They are unwilling to take the risk that real creativity entails. But an artist must challenge, must controvert the established order. To limit that creative spirit in the name of public sensibility is to deny society one of its most significant resources. Those are the words of Václav Havel, the Democratic leader of the former Czechoslovakia. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Caroline Levine. We're talking about her book, Provoking Democracy, Why We Need the Arts. Well, Havel's kind of an interesting figure since he was both politician and artist. Mm-hmm. Can you say something in general about the role that governments have played in relationship to the arts?
Governments have tended to be split. Democratic governments have tended to be split over the arts, where populist politicians will often say, this work offends me, this work is elitist, I want to get rid of this work of art. But governments have also – democratic governments have also wanted to try to prove that democracies are free societies. And sometimes they've also tried to use the arts to demonstrate that. So one of the most – extraordinary examples of this, I think, is Jackson Pollock, who during the Cold War was used as a vehicle of propaganda for the U.S. Soviets had been saying that the U.S. was a kind of shallow materialist culture. It was all about Hollywood movies. It didn't have a genuine culture. And it wasn't really a free society because you had to conform to this kind of consumerist status quo. And CIA officials came up with this sneaky plan to sponsor radical American art. And they did it secretly because the artists themselves would not have wanted to be sponsored by the CIA in part.
There's an irony.
Yeah, there's an irony. And also the populist politicians in Congress, people like McCarthy, would never have allowed this kind of sponsorship of these left-wing artists. Most of them had left-leaning sympathies in any case. So they, through lots of hidden funding sources, they catapulted Jackson Pollock to fame almost single-handedly. And then they could point to Pollock and say, you think the U.S. isn't a free society? Well, check this guy out. Look how free we must be if Jack the Dripper is our most famous artist. And what I think is partly really surprising about that is how effective it was. So there were shows of abstract expressionist art in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe, in South America. And audiences came away, and you could see this in reviews at the time, they came away saying things like, wow, that U.S. is much more interesting culture than I thought. It really is a free society. And so the artist was used to demonstrate that democracies were freer than Soviet communist countries. But, you know, it was really actually kind of touch and go with McCarthy wanting to squelch art just as much as Stalin did. And you had to have this kind of covert plan to do it because governments are not able always in democracies to harness that kind of energy for freedom.
When you talk about the government, does it all come down to whether or not the government is funding a particular artist or institution that is fostering that artist? Or does government have other roles in terms of opening or closing the gates to artistic expression?
That's a great question. I think that there are a lot of ways that governments have involved themselves in artistic expression. And one of the surprises for me was, as somebody who hangs out with artists, and artists are always saying, oh, get the government out of the arts. You know, the government doesn't belong. They're always trying to channel us in ways that repress and suppress us. One of the surprises to my mind was that governments have sometimes protected artists against the pressure of majority rule in democracies. So that courts, for example, as the legislative arm of government, have sometimes come in. One of the cases that I look at in the book is the rap group Two Live Crew, which in the late 80s and early 90s was offending everybody. They were offending the right wing because they were very sexually explicit. They were offending the left wing because they had misogynist images of women. They were not popular with anybody except maybe teenagers. And they were hauled into court accused of obscenity, and there was a lot of support behind pulling their work off the shelves. But the court decided that Two Live Crew had the right to circulate, that they deserved to win their case in court because they were innovative on aesthetic grounds, that they were actually making enough of a provocation, enough of a set of innovations to existing music that if they were suppressed, then the democracy as a whole would be losing something. And specifically that they were bringing this kind of Miami beat to what had been a Bronx sound, and this fusion was in itself valuable. And so they won their case in court. So there's a case where government actually not funding the arts, but it is protecting the arts from majority rule.
But it must be hard for government officials in any of the branches to figure out how to judge art because they're not art critics.
Yeah, one of my favorite cases in the book is the case of the abstract sculptor Constantin Brancusi from the 1920s. He had a sculpture called Bird in Space, which looks a little like a bird's wing or the body of a bird. It's very abstract. It doesn't have any features of a bird, but it suggests flight. And it was brought into the U.S. An American collector wanted to buy it and bring it into the U.S. And at the harbor in New York, customs officials said, that's not art. That's That object belongs under the customs category of kitchen utensils and hospital supplies. And the difference
depends on how you use it.
Yeah, exactly. The difference between those two things is actually important, those two categories, because art can come into the country tax-free. But kitchen utensils and hospital supplies are taxed at 40% of their value. So this was a significant case. And it went to court. And the judges in that case made the decision that the art world was better at judging what should be art than government. So they deliberately kind of ceded authority. They brought a bunch of witnesses from the art world onto the stand, and they said, you know, it seems to be true that abstract art, even though we don't like it, is recognized by museums, by textbooks, by galleries, by experts in the field, by artists themselves as art. And so we're going to bow to the art world. And it was, again, one of the surprises because in doing my research, because I had always assumed that people in the courtroom were just as happy to squelch art if they didn't like it. But in fact, there's a long tradition of the courts ceding authority on questions of art to art experts on the witness stand.
Do they do the same thing in literary terms?
Absolutely. The Lady Chatterley's Lover trial is one of my favorite cases, in part because it's published in full, the full transcript of the trial, so you can see all the witnesses.
Full transcript of the novel, too.
And then, yes, well, that too. Now, thanks to that trial, we can all read the full transcript of the novel. But lots and lots of famous literary critics like Raymond Williams and Richard Hoggart and E.M. Forster, not just a critic but a writer, came onto the stand to testify to the value of Lady Chatterley's Lover. And the jury in that case, there was a jury in some of these cases, there's just a panel of judges. But the jury, who might have been expected not to like art objects that, you know, were produced by this kind of modernist experimental art world, perfectly happy to shatter sexual taboos, the jury was persuaded by this string of experts, and the law made it possible for them to say that its artistic value trumped any problem with corrupting a general populace. That was kind of that's usually the main claim in obscenity trials, right? That this is going to be this is going to be bad for everybody. It's a kind of democratic problem. But the law balances the value of art, which might only serve a few, as just as valuable as corrupting the many. So if it serves a few, it can still circulate, even if it does corrupt the many.
What about the case of art that is imposed on the public, as in the case of Central Park recently with the orange banners?
The Christo and Jean-Claude,
I'm just curious, how would that fit in here? Because it is a government-owned space, in a way, public property. And then you've got these big orange banners and money involved as well.
Yes. There's so many vexed, really controversial examples of public art where a public says, I did not choose this. We did not choose this. This is not for us.
And they're perhaps even in a way paying for it.
Yes. My money is paying for this. One of the most famous examples of this was Richard Serra's Tilted Ark. Serra has had a big show at the Museum of Modern Art just recently, and so he's been in the news again. But in the early 1980s, he was commissioned by the government to create a sculpture for a plaza in downtown Manhattan. It was a 12-foot high, 120-foot long kind of curving wall, steel wall. And it caused huge outcry. People hated it. They said, I don't want to walk around it. It's ugly. It's in my space, you know, the sense that it was in the way. And it had been imposed on people. And it was torn down, and it was destroyed. And after that incident, there was a big move, and it continues to be a kind of movement in the public art funding world, to do a lot more consultation with communities, to ask communities what it is that they want, to think about with community leaders what an appropriate work of art would be. But I actually think something was lost that was very important with that artwork, and that was this very idea that an art object might make us uncomfortable. We might not like it, but it might expand our sense of what, for example, public space is. So Richard Serra said, you know, I'm commenting not on you. You know, I'm not trying to impose on you, but to point out to you that all of public space is organized for you, that these ugly buildings that are funded, you know, by the government all around you also shape your environment, and that we could think about the environment in this way by having a sculpture kind of alter our perceptions of space.
That might also get in your way and be ugly.
Yes, of course, that do get in your way and are ugly. And, you know, unless we think about space and the use of public space, unless we engage with it critically, we passively accept a kind of status quo that may not be good for us either.
we get into these kind of interesting questions over and over again, I guess, as to the individual versus some kind of group sanction. I think there was a statue of some kind in Madison a few years ago, if I remember, in a park toward the south part of town that kept getting knocked over mm-hmm. or somehow defaced mm-hmm. because people, or certain people at least, just didn't like it.
There was a case – this is a long time ago and far away, so it may not seem as germane. But there was a case that I found very, very sobering in doing this research from the 1920s where a sculptor in England was commissioned to do a work of public art for a public park, for London's Hyde Park, this kind of important national space. And as soon as the sculpture was unveiled, there was huge outcry. People wanted it torn down. They scrawled epithets on it. And they kept saying, it's not English enough. It's not English enough. And in fact, the sculptor, Jacob Epstein, was Jewish and he was American. And so there was this sense that he was his sculpture must be inappropriate for that space. And in fact, it was not a conventional sculpture, but it wasn't offensive. It wasn't dangerous. You couldn't complain about it on any of the usual grounds. And it made me realize two things that I think are really important. One, that the style of a work of art is sometimes enough to get people exercised. So it does not have to break sexual taboos or be offensive on the grounds of religion or politics. As with Tilted Ark, the Richard Serra sculpture, it was simply strange. And that in itself is a question about freedom. How much does our public space encompass things that are strange and
don't? Do you want challenge or do you want comfort?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. But the other thing that was very sobering to me was that one of the groups that had tried to get rid of the sculpture was a fascist group, which had scrawled on it, God save our king and Britain from the cancer of Judah, of Jewishness, and it had to be cleaned off. It made me realize that there's a kind of continuum between the tyranny of the majority and fascism, so that democracy is not absolutely distinct from fascism, that desire to have a forceful people and have art that represents that people could mean squelching all kinds of things that are foreign or strange or unfamiliar, and that is the impulse of fascism. And so that was one of the reasons I felt that it was important to rethink that idea that we started with. Mm-hmm. I like it, therefore I should fund it. I don't like it, therefore I shouldn't. What is it that we include under the banner of liking? Is it only that which is familiar, that which represents a kind of recognizable mainstream national tradition? Or are there voices? And of course, we know we live in a diverse country. There are many voices and many perspectives that don't fit any kind of monolithic notion of a mainstream, that we need that too in our public space.
And what role does war play in the endangerment of the arts? When a government is also at war, how do you see the arts affected?
I think that one of the biggest paradoxes or biggest tensions for democracy happen in those moments, because when a democracy is at war, democratic majorities tend to say you can't be an outsider, you can't be a dissenter, you have to support the united collective. That's really important. If we're going to win a war, we have to seem and feel united. On the other hand, wartime is the moment when democracies also have to prove that they're free societies. They have to say it's worth fighting on our side and not on their side because we're free. And so there tends to be either a deep hypocrisy where we say, you know, we're going to give up our freedoms in the name of freedom, or a complicated set of negotiations over how much freedom we can tolerate as a society at war. And the CIA example is one example that we talked about before, but I also looked into an example in Britain in the 1940s of a movie that had been banned through the 30s. It was a movie that was called Love on the Dole, and it was really about Depression-era poverty. And at the end of the movie, a young woman sacrifices herself for her family by more or less prostituting herself to a wealthy man. And so in the 30s, that was seen to be very upsetting. It was politically disruptive to have her – seemed socially and politically disruptive to have a woman prostitute herself because poverty was so dire that she would have to do that. In 1940, the British government secretly commissioned that screenplay to be made into a movie because they thought Two things. First of all, it would show what a free society Britain had become during wartime, that they had banned this movie, and it was very public that it had been banned. Now look how free we are. We can show these kinds of scandalous stories. And secondly, her sacrifice, which had been cast as kind of immoral in the 30s, started to look like exactly what you needed during wartime, somebody willing to give up the greatest, you know, her greatest virtue of all for the sake of the collective. And so wartime propaganda for democracy is incredibly complicated. It's not just simple messages that you kind of promulgate and say, okay, you know, you must be part of the war effort. Instead, there's this always this complicated negotiation over freedom on the one hand and collectivity and unity on the other hand.
No wonder a little bit about community standard that comes up occasionally in, you know, Supreme Court cases having to do with obscenity, and obscenity is as we see, is related sometimes to the art of what's perceived to be obscenity.
Sure.
Does that ever come up in terms of what should be funded or what not? I mean, for example, you're going to have a, you know, a statue of a shepherd in cattle country, that kind of thing. you know, where it, from an absolute standpoint, yeah, this is fine, but it
right.
depends on where you're putting it.
Yes, I think that's what happens in just about every controversy over the arts. You get a sense of a community saying these are our values, these are our standards, and a sense of the artist as the person who is somehow refusing those standards and refusing to conform to them. And as you say, it changes depending on the place and the time. So it's one of the reasons why Stravinsky no longer upsets us. An artist might broaden our taste such that certain kinds of things no longer shock us, but then other things come and shock us and in other ways. And so I think that's why we – democracies actually always need artists in the tradition of the avant-garde, because no matter what the standards are, there will always be people who are outside of those standards.
Many
who
of
don't
whom
conform.
Will fall by the wayside, but
yes.
on the other hand, the Stravinskys will come through.
Right. Right.
More on provoking democracy with the arts when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
WPR.org is both a guide and a reference. It's a guide to what's coming up on Wisconsin Public Radio and a reference to more information about something you recently heard. Visit us anytime, WPR.org.
Conductor Gabriel Pierney devoted more than the usual amount of rehearsal time to Millot's and Honegger's pieces. Millot invited his parents to Paris for the big event, little expecting just what was in store for them. Even before the overture of his suite was finished, some in the audience were shouting, "Take it away!" Others made animal sounds. A backlash arose with bravos and clapping, a show of support that just did more to drown out the music. When the orchestra got to a particularly innovative fugue in the suite, a battle erupted, during which one audience member, a composer, slapped another, an organist, in the face. The police arrived and started clearing out troublemakers. With some satisfaction, Millot saw two policemen eject a prominent music critic. A story from the fall of 1920 having to do with the debut of an early work by Darius Milhaud, who went on to become a major 20th century composer. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Caroline Levine, and we're talking about democracy and the arts. One of the words that terms that we've already used in justifying art which might not appeal to me particularly or to you is avant-garde. How do we actually defend something in terms of its being avant-garde? How do we justify it?
Sometimes we talk about artists having always had the role of being outsiders and provocateurs and needlers. But something that I learned about while I was doing the research for this book is that really it was towards the end of the 19th century that artists started to adopt this role as central to the definition of what they should do, that they should be the outsiders who provoke us. For centuries, artists had actually been answerable to patrons like kings and popes, and they sometimes annoyed their patrons. Michelangelo is a famous example of that. But it's in the late 19th century that the idea that it's no longer individual patrons who are deciding what art should be, but kind of the mass public, because by the end of the 19th century, photography and print. Most people know how to read by this point. Culture starts to be disseminated to everybody. And that's when artists start to reevaluate their role as not just servants of particular powers, but in relation to democracy. And so the historical avant-gardes are a series of movements that see themselves – the word itself comes from actually from a military context. It means the front line or the vanguard, and the idea that artists are standing at the front lines of culture and kind of fighting their way for a new society for the rest of us.
Sometimes true.
Which is sometimes true. And most art historians argue that the historical avant-garde came to its end after World War II, kind of late 1940s, 1950. But I argue in my book that there is still a tradition of the avant-garde that functions in contemporary societies where anytime we define artists as outsiders who are provoking and standing outside and doing nonconformist, uncomfortable things, we're actually drawing on the logic of the avant-garde, which is that we need those outsiders always to remind us of the outside, of the fact that there are alternatives.
I'm curious that as you were working on this book, if you ran into an example that you're defending but actually feeling uncomfortable with, the way sometimes the ACLU will have to defend the right of the Nazis to march or whatever it is. Did you run into something like that where you know you need to defend it, but you're feeling a little uncomfortable with it?
To be perfectly honest, Emily, there were a lot of works of art in this book that I do not like myself. And that's why I feel honestly as though I can say that we should fund things that we don't like, because I don't like them either. Certainly, Two Live Crew is one that I had to learn a lot about in order to appreciate their value, for example. And even Richard Serra and Jacob Epstein, I felt, you know, sympathy with the mass public and, you know, not liking it. But that question of what our limits are on what we have to support even when we don't like it is a very urgent one. And should we support artworks, for example, by fundamentalist Islamists in a moment where there's a war going on with terrorist groups from that perspective? Something I came to believe when writing this book is that I'm really not afraid of any individual expression as long as it doesn't dominate. That one of the real fears is, it seems to me, is of a single version of what's right or appropriate coming to dominate the cultural scene. And so a little like the ACLU, I feel, and I'm sure there will be listeners who feel that that's troubling, but that really we do have to be committed, genuinely committed to artworks that may offend and disrupt our sensibilities on a profound level if we are going to have a genuinely free society, and that the only danger is that one of those views, and of course both fascist groups and fundamentalist groups try to dominate a society, that if any single view comes to dominate, that's where the real danger is for all of us.
There's still that issue you can't get away from, though, isn't there, of there's a difference between tolerating it and actually supporting it or endorsing it.
Yeah, and I think that that's a surprise to myself, that I think that we have to be actually active about encouraging it. That is, the things that we don't already know, feel comfortable with, and are familiar with, those are the things that we have to support.
And back to the question of then whom do we, as members of a democratic country, trust to make those decisions on our behalf?
We might actually be able to make more of them on our own behalf. That is to say, it's sort of a popular idea, widely understood convention, that you don't have to go to a museum if you don't want to, or you don't have to go to a concert if you don't want to. But we could deliberately expose ourselves to things that we're unfamiliar with and don't know and don't like. And I actually think that that would be a surprisingly easy way for us to challenge ourselves to grow in various ways. And so I'm not imagining actually an authoritarian model of imposing certain kinds of artworks on us, or even saying that the art world is always right. I certainly wouldn't agree with that. But I think that we could see ourselves, instead of thinking, oh, those elitist artists are trying to leave us out, we could say, what is that challenge to us? How could I grow potentially by exposing myself to things that I'm unfamiliar with?
How often should an arts organization, whether it's a symphony or a museum or even a public broadcasting entity, how often should they ask the public, well, what do you want to see or hear?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. How often? Every third program.
Well, because, sure. You know, I mean, it's in a lot of the arts, and I would include a lot of broadcasting in this, public broadcasting in particular, is a question of do you lead or do you follow?
Yes, 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 yes. You know, I would like to reconceive that question such that we would think of ourselves as always both leading and following, that is, ordinary citizens, public radio, professors, whoever it is who's dealing in cultural objects, that we would have both a debate and an understanding of what kinds of cultural objects speak to us as a population, what are traditional, what speak to a long tradition of being in Wisconsin or being in the United States or whatever it is, or being a member of a particular ethnic group, and also always thinking about what's outside of that, what else could we be thinking of, and so that it wouldn't be that there would be mandarins who would tell us which or invite us to do it, but that we would always be participating that way.
Your topic overlaps with the whole issue of academic freedom in general and the sort of elitist attitude that can be at universities. And I was wondering if you could read a little bit. We wouldn't have time for the whole thing, but you include the winner of the Bad Academic Sentence Award. And I was wondering if you could read at least part of that and talk about how that fits into your topic.
In a kind of a backward way, that's an art form to be promulgated, isn't it? This is how not to do it.
Well, you know, one of the surprises to me, and I had not expected this at all, was after writing a book about the avant-garde tradition, I'm an academic. I'm a professor. I write academic writing, although I should say that this book is intended for a more general audience. I learned that the tradition of academic writing, which is very obscure and jargony and that people hate, feels like mumbo-jumbo, is actually often talked about as part of the same tradition as the avant-garde. That is, professors, people doing research, have to be on the cutting edge, on the vanguard of culture. And sometimes difficult thoughts require difficult expression. And so I wanted to devote the last chapter of my book to thinking about the relationship between artists on the one hand and academic writers, and particularly obfuscating academic writers on the other hand. So the prize-winning sentence for what's called the Bad Writing Award went to Judith Butler a few years ago. She's a gender theorist and philosopher, and it was in the journal Diacritics. The sentence reads, "The move from a structuralist account in which capital is understood to structure social relations in relatively homologous ways to a view of hegemony in which power relations are subject to repetition, convergence, and rearticulation brought the question of temporality into the thinking of structure and marked a shift from a form of Althusserian theory that takes structural totalities as theoretical objects to one in which the insights into the contingent possibility of structure inaugurate a renewed conception of hegemony as bound up with the contingent sites and strategies of the rearticulation of power."
I think I would let her use that sentence if she'll diagram it. But I guess the real test, isn't it, is can you translate that into words that are much simpler and say the same thing probably more effectively?
That is the question. And maybe I should say that is one side of the question. There's another side of the question, which is, does our very discomfort with the style of that sentence and its unfamiliarity testify not just to the difficulty of the sentence, which could possibly be written in a more lucid or more accessible way, but does our feeling of its inaccessibility actually tell us something about us too? That is, what our experience of culture feels, what we feel like it should be. Should it feel transparent, accessible, easy, or should we rise to the challenge of trying to make sense of it? And for academics, that's a complicated question because on the one hand, we want to be saying original, complicated, new things that people haven't thought before. That's part of our job in a research university, that we not just repeat what people already know. On the other hand, it's our job as professors to translate that to undergraduates, to graduate students, to say, you know, this is why this is important. This is why you should be brought into the conversation. And I see, unlike the art world, where the provocations, I think, can remain at a kind of high level of sophistication and still help us broadly. That is, they can – or even a high level of just strangeness and help us in a general way. I think academics sit on a kind of spectrum. That is, we – on the one hand, we have to say things that are avant-garde in the sense that they are new and surprising and unfamiliar. And on the other hand, we have to be able to talk to a general public, an undergraduate public, a set of graduate students who are gradually learning the specific terms of art and the kinds of jargon and specialized language that help us say complicated, difficult things. And so it seems to me that artists and academics have something in common and also something
isn't, well,
isn't
the
different.
Fundamental thing behind this – this is the way I would approach it. The fundamental question for a sentence like this or a white on white or any number of other things, how much do you trust that person? Are they putting you on or are they putting themselves on or do they really believe and are they really trying to communicate as best they can to you in what they say?
That is, I think, a really helpful question because I wonder if we would have a different kind of public culture if we took for granted that everyone was
sincere.
Sincere even if they're, you know, satirizing or mocking, you know, even if they're – that it's always an exploration and that very few people really actually like to slap us in the face. That is to say, most people are in and artists, I think, are among the most serious investigators of kind of the grounds of our experience, just trying to figure out what it is that experience is made up of. And sometimes that is – it seems either simple or obvious. But, you know, if we think of a group like the Impressionists who – now seem very beautiful and very tame to us in the original moment of their public displays of their paintings, they were very shocking to people and very scandalous because they were literally breaking apart the conventions of painting. And sometimes the breaking apart of conventions looks silly or strange or self-indulgent, but it's frequently a very thought-provoking and even philosophical exercise. So it seems to me that we would have maybe just – we'd do better ourselves if we just took for granted, even if it was sometimes not true, if we took for granted
give them the benefit
that,
of the doubt.
That there is a sincere and authentic
and
attempt.
Nobody's just trying to show off and get tenure.
Right.
Are there recent examples that you can call our attention to that illustrate this ongoing debate between the democracies and the arts?
Sure. Just an example that's going on right now and is in the news quite often is a play called My Name is Rachel Corrie, which is based on the story, as you might remember, of Rachel Corrie, who was a young American activist who went to protest the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And she stood in front of what she thought was – and said she thought was a Palestinian home. The Israelis understood it to be hiding a cache of arms and were intending to bulldoze the home, and they bulldozed her to death in the process. This play is based on her letters and diaries. It's a one-woman play, and it obviously taps into really vexed questions about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and people have really strong emotions about that. But theater companies all over the country have been trying to put this on stage and have withdrawn it, not only in the U.S. but also in Canada. There have been attempts to stage it, which have then been withdrawn. And I think it asks this question again of whether we as a society have to already have agreed on a solution, you know, have a consensus democratic opinion on a subject, or whether we can allow art to start a process of what might be a very uncomfortable conversation, but which nonetheless we have to have. And so that's a case where the artwork is provoking us and where many communities are saying, no, we're not ready to have that conversation. And I think we might want to be ready, even if it's difficult for us to do that.
Well, we didn't solve any any age-old riddles here, but we certainly opened a good can of worms. And let's see. Let's mix the metaphor some more and say it's food for thought.
Worms who are food for thought.
Well, if you're an avant-garde dietitian, maybe yeah, so. You never know.
Indeed.
100 years from now, that might be just the thing.
And we can have a work of art with just a can of worms for people to look at.
The can has been done, but it was a soup can. Our guest this hour has been Caroline Levine, and a pleasure of provoking thoughts about the arts and the freedom thereof.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for being with us. And I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next controversial hour of University of the Air.